This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Even during the US presidential campaign, Donald Trump blasted the Paris Accord on climate change, saying it imposed wildly unfair environmental standards on American businesses and workers. He has lived up to that promise and pulled the US out of the landmark 2015 pact. So following the US's decision, the EU actually emerged saying that they will take a lead and continue the fight against global warming, with the French president even coming out to say, let's make our planet great again. On today's episode of Earth Matters, I first speak to Her Excellency Maria Castillo Fernandez. She is the ambassador and head of delegation for the European Union delegation to Malaysia, and she discusses the EU's response to Trump's decision and how they intend to lead in the fight to halt global warming. So we want to talk about Trump and pulling out of the Paris Agreement, but he blasted the Paris Accord even during the 2016 presidential campaign. You know, he said things that it would cost the US economy trillions of dollars, no tangible environmental benefit from it. Have European leaders been bracing themselves for him to fulfill his pledge, you know, to break from the Paris Pact even from then?
Well, we knew about his campaign pledge, but there's always hope. So certainly we were hoping to convince him to change. And certainly this has not happened. So it's a sad moment, and we are disappointed. Certainly deeply regret the American position. Because the Paris Agreement was a big challenge for all of us. It brought us all together at a very challenging moment. It's an unprecedented agreement, a multilateral agreement. There was an enormous effort done by everyone, including the Americans, us, everyone, nations, Africans, all of us together, to bring more than 195 countries with one simple goal, and all of us looking at that goal, trying to fulfill it. So it is a very ambitious agreement, but each country has its own path. It's not prescripted. It doesn't oblige a country to follow a given path. Each country, as you know, can make its own plans how they could reduce greenhouse emissions within its needs, within its possibilities, and each one can follow that path. So there was room, enough room for the Americans also to prepare their own path in this agreement. So it is there, but the Paris Agreement is not off. It's there. It will deliver, and certainly Europe and many other countries, I think, will get together and try to lead the efforts to fight climate change.
And, you know, you did mention that when you heard about his presidential campaign that, you know, the EU did try to sort of, I suppose, work to stop him from making that decision. So what sort of efforts did the EU take to try and persuade him against this?
Well, I think there has been efforts done not only by the EU, but by many, many other partners all over the world.
The Pope, even.
The Pope, that's true. I think in all his multilateral, bilateral meetings with us and with all other partners, everyone was trying to pass the same message. We need America in, and this is a fight for all of us. Climate has changed, has an impact in every country. There is no boundaries, and we cannot fight it alone. So certainly it is a fight that we have to keep it, do it together. Not only governments, we have business, we have companies, we have civil society together. And there are many American business and civil society which have said that they are in. So certainly we are going to reach to all of them. I remember the recent meetings in Europe, in NATO summit or the G7, those were about climate change. And climate change was in the agenda of those meetings. So certainly we have tried to convince, our leaders have tried to convince him and convince the administration. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we are going to reach those Americans, being states, being companies, being civil society communities that are very much in favor, and they have said that they are committed. This effort is not only about governments. I think each of us, you and me, our children, our family, everyone can contribute in its own way. And business have a lot to contribute, and communities as well. So certainly, we need, if there is in America communities and business which are coming along, that can certainly, you know, be beneficial to all of us.
So how do you actually hope to do that? I mean, because this is basically, I suppose, working around the federal government of the US and what they've decided. Because I read that, you know, European policymakers, they want to explore ways of enticing American energy innovators, for example, and climate researchers to relocate to Europe. Are there plans for this as far as you know? And, you know, for example, using tax advantages and government subsidies to attract them?
Attracting talents is something that all countries and all companies do in any field. So there will certainly, today we see a lot of efforts put in innovation, put in green research and green technology. Companies are amongst the first in really to change these patterns. Mm-hmm. So certainly they will be, you know, offering possibilities, but this has been done before and after, so that is not a trigger of this decision.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think the repercussions of this move will be on the US itself? I mean, do you think they're going to, for example, miss out in terms of commercial opportunities and green growth, those sorts of things?
Well, certainly there must be an impact, and if you are focused less on green growth, you are going to miss the path that many countries are now taking, Europeans and non-Europeans, towards a low-carbon economy, towards a more clean energy economy, more clean energy-efficient economy. And we are all working into that path, and that means also innovation technology. And there are opportunities, but as I said, many American companies, communities are also wanted to go into that path. So we will, you know, America will continue in a lesser or in a less quick path. But certainly there is a trend of all of us to go into that direction. Malaysia as well. You know, here we are, since I've been here in the last months, it's all about green technology. It's about innovation. It's about sustainability. It's about forest management, sustainable forest management. So there are so many things that Malaysia has also to offer in this area. And that will be, you know, part of the big work and big commitment that Malaysia has also made to climate change. And when I say that we then will forge, you know, Europe will lead and will forge new alliance, certainly with Malaysia, we are trying to work very closely in order to make Paris succeed.
Because, you know, the Paris Agreement, it hinged on developed countries, you know, like the US, like the countries in the EU, whose economies have contributed to emissions historically, helping to finance, you know, developing countries like Malaysia, for example, their transition to cleaner forms of energy. So do you think then there will be a very huge impact with the US pullout, or, you know, are the EU sort of, I suppose, stepping up or trying to fill that gap in any way?
Well, certainly there will be an impact in what we call climate finance, because the US has said that they will pull out of funds like the Green Climate Change Fund. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean we will continue with our commitments. And I think Europe and its European countries are the biggest climate finance world donor. That commitment is also not made only by Europe, by all developed countries to help the most poor and the most vulnerable countries. It's part of the Paris commitment, not only ourselves to embrace certain targets in green emissions, but also help the others to come along. And we will continue certainly with that. Even in 2015, we already committed more than 17 billion euros only on climate change finance. So we have been doing our part. We need now to forge more alliance with other partners, other third countries, and these partners can also be business. It can be, you know, trying to bring the right public and private investment into climate. And the business, and I come back to them, have their own stake in all this. It's about research. It's about putting and transforming themselves into an economy that it will be different. There is an economic and social transformation here, which is behind Paris, which is very important, because we are going to say the way business are done, the way we make or move around society, our society models, they will be more clean, there will be much more awareness. Mm-hmm. Awareness is also a key element in all this, in all this fight against climate. We need to make aware. We have to start from the very beginning. And if we don't bring up also awareness, to our children, to our students, which will be the generations. This is all for them. So they are the ones who are much more committed in a way because they know how important this will be for them. So we are working very closely. I'm thinking about awareness because in Malaysia we are trying to reach out to students in university, trying to discuss with them climate change policies, but also taking our bicycles with them and and trying to make a point that sometimes simple acts like just making use of bicycles and then the local community is preparing the path so that bicycles can move around is some simple issues, but that could, you know, that are things that people like, things that people care, and that can bring people together.
Yeah, very tangible, everyday
yes,
things.
Absolutely.
That, you know,
there are so many tangible things we can do. Just another example is plastic bags, you know, and when I go and do my shopping here in KL, I always bring my plastic bags because I am accustomed now to do it in Europe. And when they look at me, they say, oh, but here we have. And so it's not yet done. And you have to battle to have your own
shopping bags. Plastic bags.
But certainly, I mean, this will come. It's a process, I mm-hmm. think, and a learning process. And these are two examples of simple things that, you know, we do in our daily lives and that can make a change. That's why I say it's not about only governments, but it's also about people.
Yeah, because, you know, just looking in Selangor, for example, they've banned the use of plastic bags. And I can just see even in my little office here, you know, people are like, bringing their shopping bags.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
They're doing
well, that would change. You will see in 5 years' time, you remember me.
So I guess it's safe to say that the EU pretty much going to take a leadership role now in this effort towards fighting global warming and climate change.
Yes, we will. We will. Certainly there's an overwhelming commitment from all EU leaders that Europe will lead. But Europe needs also partners and therefore strengthen our relations with our key partners, but also forging new relations with partners that can be countries, it can be communities, it can be business, it can be civil society, working all together. And that is what is important. Malaysia is also part of this effort, so certainly working very closely with Malaysia in order to try to each of us fulfill our national plans and trying to help the others as well.
And just to conclude, Your Excellency, do you think then that, you know, this move has actually catalyzed people into, I mean, it's brought climate change unprecedented, I would say, awareness because everyone is talking about it. It's, you know, it's happening. So do you think there's actually some positives that have actually come up from Trump's decision?
Well, there are always positive things in every decision. We have to look to the positive side as well. And certainly it has bring climate change up in the agenda, as you said, and more people are aware, more people are saying, okay, no, well, then we will work together. So it has put partners more closely together. I look at the example of EU and China when the summit was being held in Brussels and the Americans took the decision. So that brought them together in fighting against climate change. We need China on board as well. It's one of the big partners here. So you put more countries, you put more people, then you see some American firms, American state coming out saying, I will commit myself. So that is also positive. And then you see climate as part of the discussions here, but also at homes, make people, as I said, very aware. And everything is about us, as I said, and that's my message. Everyone matters in climate change, in the fight against climate change. From you to me to every little boy in his normal day-to-day school life. So we have to start from them, and everyone matters. And whatever everyone in as a single person can make, that could make a difference. Yeah. And we have to bring that. And that is the fight that we all have to do to have a better planet for you, for the next generation.
Because there's no borders, as you said.
No, there's no borders. This is affect us all. We all have a stake here.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. A pleasure. Thank you.
That was Her Excellency Maria Castillo Fernandez. She's the ambassador and head of delegation for the European Union delegation to Malaysia, speaking about the EU's continued commitment to the Paris Agreement. We take a quick break now. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Earlier, I spoke to Her Excellency Maria Castillo Fernandez, the ambassador and head of delegation for the European Union delegation to Malaysia, who spoke to me about the EU's continued commitment to the Paris Agreement. Now I speak to Datuk Dr. Gudiel Singh Nija, who was a negotiator and lead spokesman for like-minded developing countries at COP21 in Paris back in 2015. He joins me to discuss Trump's decision and what impact he foresees this pullout will have on the world. Hi, Professor Gudiel. How are you today?
Yes, fine. Thank you.
So, I mean, how did you feel when, you know, President Trump finally made that decision to pull the United States out of the Paris Agreement on climate change? I mean, he threatened to do it, you know, all through his presidential campaign. Were you surprised at all?
In a sense, not surprised at all, because I think there are other forces at work also. You see, Trump is really being used as a vehicle by the fossil fuel industry. I was just reading this article by the New Yorker of June 5th. And even Al Gore, in an interview on ABC's very recently, said he cited dark money from fossil fuel companies as the explanation for Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Accord. Mm-hmm. And John Kerry, who took a very active role in the Paris Agreement negotiations, on NBC's Meet the Press, he specifically chastised a Kansas-based advocacy group, you know, headed by the Koch family, as having got their way in getting Trump to declare the withdrawal.
I mean, the agreement actually hinges on developed countries like the United States, who you know, historically their economies have contributed more emissions, right?
Yes.
And so it hinges on them helping to finance developing countries' transition to cleaner forms of energy. What exactly did the U.S. commit to in the Paris Agreement under Obama? I mean, very broadly.
Broadly speaking, I think they agreed that the developed countries had to take the lead, mm-hmm. and that they, if they wanted developing countries to come on board, they had to provide what we call the means of implementation, which included the provision of finance for countries to switch from the cheaper coal to renewables, as well as technology transfer to use those technologies that are related to renewables, mm-hmm. As well as capacity building. So that was the long-term plan. Mm-hmm. They have accepted responsibility under the UN Convention on Climate Change for the historical responsibility for having used up, for having created this climate problem because of their over-reliance on fossil fuels since the 1700s.
Yeah.
So they agreed on what they call common but differentiated responsibilities. And it was not only in respect of mitigation, which means, you know, you cut down on coal, and which would spell a lot of problems for developing countries because, you know, we use cheaper means. Malaysia, for example, mm-hmm. you know, the TNB uses coal for purposes of generating energy for electricity.
Yeah.
And we can imagine all the SMEs, the small and medium enterprises, if they had to switch overnight without any support to renewables, many of them will go out of business. The country's economy, as far as SMEs are concerned, will collapse. That is why when we negotiated, we said, fine, you know, we are prepared. We made a commitment under the NDCs, Nationally Determined Contributions, to reduce. Malaysia agreed to reduce by 40% from pre-industrial levels. But we said that for us to switch and switch effectively, it has to be proportionate to the financial aid that they had committed themselves to, mm-hmm. but were not providing.
So now that they've decided to pull out, where does that leave developing countries? I mean, Malaysia in particular.
Well, I mean, the US has pulled out, which means there'll be a big gap in terms of the financial contribution. They're supposed to contribute something like $3
billion. Because mm-hmm. I think that's what Obama promised, right? About $3
billion. Yes, that's under the Green Climate Fund as their responsibility. Developed countries, the rest of the developed countries will have to step up their contribution. They have not been that, efficient in or responsible in fulfilling their obligations, because they had agreed to give $100 billion per year up to 2020. Only $10 billion materialized. And after 2030, and they also did not want any financial commitment to be included in the Paris Agreement itself, mm-hmm. but they introduced it by way of a decision of the developing countries insisted. And thereafter 2030, they have to also begin to make substantial contributions. Judged by their past record, it's not good. But the expectation now is that Europe and the rest of the developed world will live up to the responsibilities and fill the gap. Mm-hmm. And of course, developing countries, to the extent possible, they are putting in as much as possible. China and India have accelerated their reduction of emissions. China is, I think, 10 years ahead of time. India is also ahead of time by several years. So the lead developing countries like China and India have actually taken on board very seriously their obligations under the Paris Agreement. They are not even obligations. Mm-hmm. They are recommendations, you know. They are advisory in nature. And they have done their bit. But the developed countries now will have to step up. They have indicated that they will step up. Europe, France, and so on, Germany. But now the test of the pudding will lie in the eating, you see.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned China and India, because I think they were mentioned several times as well by President Trump. You know, he listed some of the main reasons why the U.S. was withdrawing was to cut. He said that under the agreement, China will be able to increase the emissions by a staggering number of years, contingent 13. They can do whatever they want for 13 years, not us. India makes its participation contingent on receiving billions and billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid from developed countries. There are many other examples, but the bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level of the United States. Is any of this even true?
I think first it flies in the face of existing evidence. I don't know what his advisors have been telling him, mm-hmm. but it is now common ground that China's emissions have peaked more than 10 years sooner than pledged. And India is expected to obtain 40% of its electricity from non-fossil fuel sources by 2022, which is 8 years ahead of schedule. So I don't know what Trump means by spewing out these kind of comments, because they're not correct. And we must not forget that first is, under the UN Convention, developed countries took on the role. The U.S. is the biggest per capita polluter, yep. All right? They are going on absolute terms, which doesn't make sense, because 50% of the world's population that is housed in developing countries, out of that, 70% of the world's poorest exist. Yeah. So now, when you talk in terms of absolute figures, it does not make sense, because India and China, their population is vast, 1.4 billion, 1.2 billion, is 2 point something billion. You have to look at per capita, all right? Per capita means how much is being polluted. And if you look at how much each person is emitting, which has to be addressed. And if you look at the figures, you'll find that as far as, if you look at 2015 figures, the U.S. in terms of per capita emission was 16.1 tons. India was 1.9 tons. Hmm. And China was 7.7 tons. All right?
Okay.
So it's unfair to ask China and India to have the same mitigation targets as the US, because what it means then is that if you ask 1.4 billion to reduce by a certain amount, I mean, they already house a large amount of the poor.
Yeah.
That means they'll have to be sub-poor level. Now, these are the figures that his advisors are not giving out to Trump, or he's ignoring these figures, which we brought about during the negotiations, highlighted these facts. As a result of that, the Paris Agreement was shaped in the way it was, which is that developed countries, including the largest polluter per capita, which is the US, had to take the lead. And other countries, if they could, there was a recommendatory provision that, to the extent possible. Now, China and India and all of the rest of the countries are falling in line. They've already given their national determined contributions, yep. right? They have already made commitments well ahead of time. The U.S. was required to do it between 20 to 26%. Now it is reversed in terms of its national policies. It has reversed a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And it is sending a very bad signal. Although, mercifully, I think, a large number of the states in the U.S., yeah. As well as Fortune 100 companies, a large number of them, according to the New Yorker, have made a commitment to say that they are for the Paris Agreement and they oppose the withdrawal by Trump from the Paris Agreement.
So I suppose then, can they make any difference, you know, regardless of what Trump's decision is, what his decision was?
Well, in a sense, they can because, you know, states determine industrial policies.
Yeah.
So you can, for example, in Malaysia, if Selangor or Penang wants to take certain measures, right, they can do that. Mm-hmm. But there is a big interface with the federal setup.
Exactly.
If the federal setup does not require, does not obligate certain measures to be taken, you know, that are beneficial for climate change reduction, then you find that at every stage there would be industry that would put up a front opposing whatever measures are going to be taken by the state. So it requires industry to be on board, some industries on board, but the main industry, which is the fossil fuel industry in the US, is against it.
And I mean, you were there, you know, you helped negotiate it. You know, and Trump seems to think that he can negotiate to make a fairer deal. I mean, this was something that was not just an overnight thing, you know, it was almost 20 years of, you know, negotiating and everything. I mean, is it that easy for him to just pull out and say that I want to renegotiate?
Well, first is the pullout, right? Mm-hmm. Countries are allowed to pull out. There is Article 28 of the Paris Agreement, which says that you can withdraw.
Okay.
But there are certain terms attached to the withdrawal. First is you cannot do it. You have to give 3 years. You cannot withdraw until 3 years have lapsed.
Okay.
From the date of the Paris Agreement.
Okay. So this will be
2018.
Yeah.
And then from the date when you notify the secretariat of the convention of your withdrawal, it will only come into effect 1 year thereafter, which means we are talking about 26 November 2019.
Right.
So you can't just withdraw, right? The signal that is sent is, oh, we have withdrawn and end of the story. Mm-hmm. But no, they're still members. They're still participating. There was a meeting last week, intersessional meeting of the Paris Agreement. They participated. And they will continue to participate. So that's the first point. Now, as far as renegotiating is concerned, you see, there are 195 countries on board in the climate change, as parties to the climate change Paris Agreement. You can't decide to renegotiate. What you are saying is we want to amend the terms of the Paris Agreement. Now, amendment requires consensus. Mm-hmm. It took a long, hard, rancorous negotiations for the last just 4 years preceding the conclusion of the Paris Agreement. For this to be shaped, it almost fell apart. And it was quite skillful leadership stewardship by the French that I think resulted in the agreement, in the conclusion of the agreement. So to suggest that we can renegotiate, while it might send, you know, beneficial signals to the populace that Trump is addressing, yep, is not practical. What he's suggesting is that this is while it is a public relations exercise, but in effect what he's saying is he's killing the agreement.
And like you said, a consensus is needed, right? So that means it requires all the other nations' leaders to come together to agree that they want to renegotiate, in essence. Is that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and so I don't think that's happening because everyone seems to have come out against what he said.
Yes.
Do you think that this move would then discourage developing nations from taking further steps to limit emissions? I mean, you've spoken about China and India, but what about, you know, other developing countries?
No, I think other developing countries are seriously on board. I mean, you look at the small island developing countries, developing states, SIDS we call them. Mm-hmm. Now, for them, it's a matter of life and death.
Exactly.
So they are very serious in pushing for climate change and for other countries to fulfill their obligations. Large number of developing countries, Malaysia included, are also very much on board. The like-minded developing countries comprised 28 countries, you know, ranging from the smallest like Cuba to the biggest like China, in Malaysia included. So I think this is fortifying the effort of other countries, the resolve of other countries to really push ahead, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is that because America, US is the largest polluter per capita, without their role, they will effectively, or to a large extent, undermine the ability of the planet to cope with emissions because, you know, we are integrated. There's no boundary, no visa required for emissions to spread and cause global warming.
So let's go through some of the reasons. You know, I mean, Trump also said that even if the Paris Agreement were implemented in full with total compliance from all nations, it is estimated it would only produce 0.2 degrees Celsius reduction in global temperature by the year 2100. So anyway, this claim was apparently attributed to research conducted by MIT from a study they published in April 2016, which said how much of a difference will the Paris Agreement make? And that actually showed that if countries abided by their pledges in the deal, global warming would slow between 0.6 degrees and 1.1 degrees Celsius by 2100. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first is he's relying on an MIT study, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The first point I want to make is that the researchers have themselves disassociated from Trump and said that he took their figures out of context and that they are against leaving the Paris Agreement. Yeah. There are also many scientists have now spoken up to say Trump's use of the data purported to be from MIT is absolutely misleading, and that Paris pledges would actually make significant progress, though perhaps they have indicated some of them that it may not be enough. Now, MIT said the 0.2 degree figure used reflects the incremental impact of a Paris Agreement compared with the earlier Copenhagen Accord, if you'll recall, right? The failed Copenhagen Accord.
Yeah.
Now, if you compare the impact of the Paris Agreement to no climate policy, which is what Trump is advocating, then the temperature reduction is much larger on the order of 1 degree Celsius to 1.8 degrees Celsius by 2100, which is a significant reduction in global temperature. And this is assuming that other countries are not going to increase their pledges, you see. If they increase their pledges, then the reduction will be even more significant. So in short, Trump's use of these figures to justify his action is actually disingenuous, and I won't use any other epithets.
Because he repeatedly, you know, touched on the theme that U.S. was being taken advantage of, you know, by all these foreign ingrates, you know, unfair restrictions were placed on the U.S. I mean, that is not true, right? First of all, nothing was forced upon them. It was all, it's all
no,
voluntary.
In fact, to a large, John Kerry was there. You know, there was very high profile participation by the U.S. government. John Kerry was there. I mean, we were unhappy with a large number of the assertions made by John Kerry because it was to the advantage of the U.S. But everybody in the spirit of consensus then came on board, right, on the broad basis that we were actually implementing the convention and not undermining the UN convention under which the Paris Agreement was being negotiated. So the US had a very significant role in determining the outcome, even right up to the last minute, right, where there was a bit of a sleight of hand where they changed the shell to May.
Yes, I remember that.
All right, yeah. So to suggest that they were very well represented, I mean, especially compared to developing countries, we had a small coterie of negotiators. They were hugely represented. And of course, you know, their backup, as you know, is huge. So I don't know what Trump is talking about. He needs to kind of get a proper appraisal of how the negotiations proceeded. And of course, you know, like I said earlier, he is a vehicle being used by the fossil fuel industry to promote their interest. And they have been under the radar because the Koch family, for example, you know, he has said we must keep under the radar. Now they are appearing a little more visible. But, you know, their policy has been, and they make this quote, which is, you know, it's when the whale begins to spout that it gets harpooned. So remain below sea level, you see.
Below the water. Could you just remind us then about Malaysia's commitments to the Paris Agreement? I mean, our minister has come out and said that, you know, we are going to keep with our promises and we are well on our way. What are your thoughts on this, if you could give us a report card so far?
Well, I think Malaysia's commitment, they have made the commitments on the NDC. There is a team of well-placed personnel, officers in the Ministry of, led by the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. The minister is very engaged on this process, very committed to this process. And so I think they are doing their best to try to fulfill the commitment they made under the NDC. Of course, it's not very easy because, you know, you have to get data from, you know, you want to reduce emissions across the board. You got to look at every industry You got to look at every agency that is participating in. You got to get the data in. So it's a long process, but I think they are crunching the figures, and it is on the basis of those crunch figures that they made the commitment. And to the best of my knowledge, I think they are on track. Of course, you know, sometimes there can be a slip away from the target. Sometimes the target can be exceeded. But Malaysia will have to begin to take their commitments rather seriously in trying to get renewables. They got to latch on to the Green Climate Fund, because the Green Climate Fund is an important source that will offset the kind of costs involved in trying to seek from the West technology that will help with regard to renewables, for example. So they should tap into the Green Climate Fund intelligently. And they can do this by making commitments, especially by government-linked companies, the lead government-linked companies, to reduce emissions where they have actual direct control, okay, as well as where state governments have control, federal government has control. Transportation policies, for example, you've got to reduce the usage of cars by having an efficient transport system.
Public transport
system. Yes, public transport system. Areas like this, and of course, you know, ensure that the forests are not cut because they are the sink for carbon, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So there has to be a very concerted direct policy, and I think they've got everything on board. But now it's the implementation stage and the effectiveness of the implementation that will be the real challenge for our government.
Just to conclude, you know, do you think that, you know, there will be a positive outcome at all from all of this, from President Trump's, you know, I mean, you know, sometimes do we need to hit rock bottom before, you know, people actually start paying attention to something?
Well, maybe so, you know, because there has been a reaction against Trump. In a sense, Trump has provoked a lot of adverse comments against his policies, with regard ranging from, you know, the very mundane to now the climate change. So in a sense, I think maybe the silver lining is that now people are alert to the fact that his policies are not being well thought through, or his advisors are not, you know, taking on board the reality. So they're beginning to look at the figures, beginning to demolish Trump's assertions. And like I said, you have Al Gore and John Kerry, Obama from the highest level, two industry Fortune 100 companies, for example, companies like Disney and so on and so forth. Google and so on. Right down to state levels and the local levels, mm-hmm, which are actively involved in repudiating some of the contentions that he has made. And of course, we have had renewed commitment by, like I said, China, India, Malaysia, and the like-minded developing countries, 28 countries. We have also had the small island states who are going to be adversely affected coming out very strongly. And of course, in Europe, you have Germany, France, Italy, Canada, as well as the whole European Union leadership, which has come up to say that, look, you know, we've got to take this on board, got to take the bull by the horns, the US by the horns. And I think in a sense it's good because, you know, the kind of policies that the US is now implementing, they are losing, I think, their leadership role. And maybe the over-dominance of the US in terms of the climate change will then filter through to the rest of the other policies that they are implementing. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should begin to have different fulcrum of power, you know.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is a good time for Asia itself, Asia and ASEAN, to reassert itself as world leaders in thought leadership with regard to climate change. And perhaps this will lead to other areas as well. I think this is, in a sense, this is the silver lining that we can hope to count on.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Datuk Dr. Gudiel Signija, who was a negotiator and lead spokesman for like-minded developing countries at COP21 in Paris back in 2015. You have been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.